Hello, welcome back to Relevant Tones. I am your host this week, Matthew Dosland. Today, I am delighted to be joined by the wonderful musician, Vijay Iyer. Vijay, how are you today?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for making the time. It's a great pleasure just to be talking with someone who has such a varied career in a space that I think is people are more conscious of than they've ever been in the past, but maybe not genre defined. You're in that space, you act as a jazz musician, you act as a classical musician, whatever those terms mean these days anymore. But you recently released a new album with your jazz trio, Compassion, and then you've recently also done some work with the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, which is your most recent album as of us talking. First, I just want to get a little bit of background on how the album Trouble, how that kind of came to be. What was the timeline like on that project? Because there's a lot of, I mean, there's three pretty big works I would say on that album. So how long did it take to start that process?
Well, the thank you. Those three pieces that are on this recording were composed and premiered from 2017 to 2019, and it was so Gil Rose, who runs Boston Modern Orchestra Project, or BMOP as they go by, it was his initiative to take on one of those pieces, the piece that's called Trouble. Which is a violin concerto with Jennifer Koh as the soloist. They programmed it on their performance series in Boston, that beautiful hall at New England Conservatory. I think at the end of 2018, and then they just said, "Well, as long as we've worked it up, we may as well record it." And then he said, "Hey, you got anything else? Maybe we could make a portrait CD," since that's what they do. They put out these portrait albums of composers, they still make CDs, which is a nice, interesting thing. In fact, they're high res SA CDs. I didn't know anybody still did that or still listened to those. But I'm glad to see it that there's some commitment to high fidelity, to high-end audio. And so then they ended up taking on these other two pieces, which were kind of one of which had been written, and the other was written soon after that. So the first recording session for Trouble was that end of 2018. The next ones were during and after, or during, I guess we're still during the pandemic. So we did them in 21, 22, I guess. And then they sat around for a long time in the queue because they put out a lot of music, actually. And finally, we got to pull the put mix them and get them into shape for release this spring. Once the wheels were turning, it was a pretty quick turnaround, actually. It's just that a lot of it had been sitting around for some years. It's been really nice to work in this format. I mean, I've been writing orchestral and chamber music and music for solo classically trained soloists and so on for close to 20 years, I guess, and it's just become another part of what I do. It's sort of less heralded, I guess, in the scope of my career. Fewer people know about it, maybe. But it's been something that's been ongoing for quite some time.
Well, you were raised very much so in the classical kind of tradition, from what I understand, with violin lessons and those kinds of things. Do you just have an affinity for the violin, for sticking around in that classical music space? Is there any reason you've kept coming back to it over all the years, as opposed to, you do so much work in jazz as well, you're also a teacher, you're a professor actively. You could choose to spend your time not writing for orchestra, which is not an easy thing to get played,
Yeah.
programmed, recorded, as you know.
Sure. I think it's partly like living in New York, and if you are open to different kinds of interactions. Like once you start playing in public in New York City, you start running across folks. Like people will show up and ask you a question, and that might one thing might lead to another, and suddenly you're writing a violin concerto. So that's kind of what happened actually with I guess what I'd say more to the point is that the community of artists in and around New York is pretty vast and eclectic and open-minded. And so you find yourself collaborating across these nominal genres, really as a matter of course. It's not like an anomaly. And even for what I've been doing that's, quote unquote, in jazz, I mean, it's often been sort of at the edge of that category, or it's been seen that way, or just described that way. I started putting out my own albums in the mid 90s, actually, but my first large project I did that had a different footprint, let's say, that had a kind of that was not so squarely like no one could say, like, well, that's a jazz record very easily. It was this project I did, the first project I did with the poet Mike Ladd in 2003. It's called In What Language? And we called it a song cycle, even though there's no singing on it. But it's like music with poetry. And so all these pieces were composed to accommodate poems and texts. So they were kind of like mood pieces and environmental kinds of pieces. And they took on a lot of different qualities. Some of it was through composed, more almost like chamber music. Some of it was like rugged electronic music, almost hip hop oriented. And some of it had a bit of a, I don't know, I'm not a fan of the word jazz, but I guess because it had like a rhythm section and horns, then people would say it sounds like jazz to me, So it took on these different surface characteristics, but it was all in service of this larger project, which had to do with the what it was to be a person of color after 9/11, essentially. And so that's basically what the fact that there was this larger thematic arc and this and the music was in service of something larger, that kind of put me on the map to certain people as some kind of composer, like not just as a guy who wrote tunes and led a band, but like as somebody who would do these different kinds of projects. And so then I started getting invitations from folks. The first chamber pieces I wrote, one was for Imani Winds and the other was for Ethel, the string quartet. And that piece for Ethel, it was a quintet actually for them plus me. That was where I was exploring the kind of limits of so-called classical or Western notation when dealing with musicians who have classical training. Like how do you lead them to something that's more real time, that's more process driven? And so that was another piece that kind of was a little outside, out of the box a little bit of what I was associated with.
I so often see your name associated with jazz, and it's interesting that you kind of point that out, that kind of, and it really is just it's a word that has one, well, it has many meanings, I guess. It's really up to the, like, it's hard to pin down what exactly is jazz and what exactly is classical and like this Western music concept. And yeah, I would echo what you've said. Certainly, I don't think your work is just in jazz. There's certainly early things that are big band and band leadering, like leading, like you said. But when you move more into that through composed, or maybe more in that kind of, let's call it combo chamber music ensemble kind of environment, and you start working with different musicians, I think what I'm trying to get is what was that blending of kind of the jazz sensibilities as well as kind of classical training? And you brought it up a little bit, but the improvisation and working with classical musicians on something that, isn't 100% a new technique. They've probably run into it before, but when you're trying to create something that's really emotionally process driven, how does that change if you're working with, say, your trio, like you were with Compassion, with Linda Mahon Oh and Tyshawn Sorey, as opposed to when you have to walk into the New England Conservatory Recital Hall and talk with Gil Rose or Jennifer Koh, who's also a longtime collaborator with you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it became an ongoing feature of my, let's, I don't know what to call it. Concert music is what Shot, the publisher, calls it. The basically notated music for Western classically trained musicians. It became an ongoing feature that there would be some sort of real-time element in it. The piece I mentioned that I did with Ethel that I recorded years later, it came out in 2014. It's the album Mutations that has this piano quintet on there. It involves some electronics and some of the movement. It's 10 movements. Some of them are through compo like just fully notated. Some of them are just text, just like a set of instructions. Some of them are about like cueing, and I invite the players to make, basically to undergo mutations in the material that they're playing. So there's something that's supposed to cycle, but each repeat you do something to it. So it you get this emergent modulation happening or something. And those are on they're basically kind of stochastic processes, meaning that the outcome is not defined, only the process itself is defined. And so you don't know exactly what you will get in the next measure. And so then for me, so then like I had to play in a way that's responding to what that is. There are other moments where I am asking them to. I actually learned this from working with Roscoe Mitchell. He would have this, way of dealing with musicians who are from that background, who have Western classical training. He does this piece called Cards, where he has a bunch of notated material that he cuts up into like index card size chunks. And then he shuffles the deck and he deals a hand to people. So then they have this array of fragments of notation sitting in front of them, which then they are empowered to kind of dip into in a way that's essentially they can grab a small piece of something and interpret it. If you ask a classically trained musician to make something up, that's going to kind of make them freeze. I see, let the record show that Matthew just froze when I said
I had
that.
the deer in headlights look that
That's
every
right.
cellist
That's right.
gets.
But if you ask them to interpret something, they can do that. And in fact, they can be very creative in the way they interpret. They can come up with all kinds of options of how to interpret something that's right in front of them. And that act of choosing sounds like something. And that's the thing. Like, it has a kind of determination behind it, a kind of intentionality behind it, and that is audible. And that sound was something I wanted to kind of harness, that capacity that classically trained musicians have. So I learned from working with Roscoe that this was an interesting way to kind of tap into that. And then I found other ways to tap into that as well, just like give them something to start with, and then give them some small steps to kind of evolve the material. I think the most intensive version of this was I did a couple of projects with Brentano Quartet, and they're such a incredibly refined, one of the greatest string quartets in the world, and their wheelhouse is like Beethoven and Mendelssohn and stuff. They also take on contemporary works, and they'll commission new pieces. And they commissioned a couple pieces from me. One was a fully notated short piece that was a response to a fragment of Mozart. And then the other was a quintet that premiered 10 years ago. And that was something that we ended up playing together a lot, like, I don't know, 15 or 20 times or something. And that's also a piece that has a bunch of like process kind of moments. There's one movement where the only instruction is to
create is to play a unison line, but I don't specify what to play or how to play it. So they then, what it does is it turns out that most of them have great ears. Often they even have perfect pitch, not always, but at least they have great relative pitch. So, and they can tell if they hear somebody, if a violinist hears another violinist play a note, then they know what note it is because they know where it is on the violin and everything. So I could actually have them step by step make a melody that way, And I call it flocking so that it's sort of like one person makes a sound, then everyone matches that sound, and then someone changes to a new sound, and then everybody matches that sound, and then step by step they create this melodic path. And then the how of it can keep evolving. Like, is it loud? Is it soft? Is it thick? Is it thin? Is it intense? Is it, And then that again becomes something I can interact with as a player. What we found also is that playing in time together, we had such different assumptions about what that means. Because I think in Western classical music, and especially in chamber music, tempo is constantly modulating, right? Or not modulating, but like
It's
flexing.
breathing. It
It's
has
breathing, yes.
that, yeah, push and
Yes. And
pull.
so, yeah, and what it means then is that every downbeat is kind of a negotiation, that, so like there's a kind of that constant breathing of tempo, which I'm familiar with because I grew up playing violin and playing solo repertoire and playing in orchestras and playing chamber music and so on. But I also grew up playing piano by ear and then studying, soul and rock and pop music and then getting into jazz. And that was where, in all of these musics, like the groove is paramount. Like tempo, steady tempo is the key to it all because often it's meant for dance, and so that steady tempo is what keeps it going. And the way what that means is that in a rhythm section, like when I'm playing with Linda and Tyshawn, we proceed from the assumption of steady tempo. So then we can interact with each other with a sort of shared metronomic sense that's kind of helping us land together, where we don't have to then articulate every beat. We don't have to keep emphasizing downbeats. We just know that we're staying together because the tempo is steady, And then we can also interact with pulse by playing around the beat with the assumption again of the beat itself being steady. So that is a mode of rhythmic expression that's very different from what you find in classical chamber music. So that was something that was really fascinating for us to discover. I remember Mark Steinberg saying that, like, playing with me gave them a whole new understanding of agogics, which is like such a radical statement. And so just like some basic things about what is emphasis, what is beat, what is time, what is a downbeat, all of that was like we had that became an interesting negotiation, so then part of it was me working more like them, and part of it was them working more like I do in a rhythm section,
That's a really interesting point. I think, yeah, it's very it within classical music, it's pretty well established that people don't really like playing behind or ahead the beat. It's very, especially in orchestras, especially in chamber music, it's very vertically oriented in that sense of, we can stretch something out, but we have to stretch something together and land here exactly in this way. And yeah, I've heard it from jazzers before, kind of the play behind the beat. And I ran into it playing in a musical pit orchestra where I had to learn on the fly how to swing eighth notes. But there is something there where the pianist in the rhythm section, I find especially the drum kit is very helpful in that it's steady, but there might be a fill might spill over a little bit or something might. The beat, you can do expressive things within the beat structure is what I've come to understand it as.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I'm curious, has any of this you've you've learned a lot, you've studied a lot, you have a few different degrees. You have a bachelor's of science in mathematics and physics from Yale, which you don't teach at Yale, you teach at Harvard, which I find funny just from the rivalry between the two schools for fun. But what has did any of these kinds of things come up when you were doing music cognition research? Because that's something I've seen that you've done a little bit of, in your far distant past at this point. But I'm wondering, does that come up ever, or those kinds of things about like how does the brain interpret something, or how does like physically, like within the physics structure of sound, how does something happen?
Well, I guess what I'd say is that you're referring to my dissertation work from the 90s. I was actually just revisiting some of it today for some reason. It was something I was trying to find, and I had a little trip down memory lane because it's more than 25 years old now, this dissertation. So, well, first of all, I quit physics when I was 23. So let nobody think that I'm a physicist, because that's almost 30 years ago, I stopped being a physicist. And so that makes me not a physicist.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, in fact, this is like the 30th anniversary of me quitting. So it's funny because I get sort of tagged constantly as the physicist who plays jazz. It's like it's so not
Yeah.
accurate. When you quit something, it's sort of like, it's like talking about someone in terms of their ex or something. Like, oh, that's the guy I used to be
Yeah.
married to, whoever. It's not that anymore. I'd like to
Of
think I can
course.
move on. But what I ended up doing, I was going to leave grad school, and then it turned out I could. So I was in grad school at UC Berkeley, and I was able to put together my own interdisciplinary program that had nothing to do with physics, but it was about. I was working. My advisors were people in music and in cognitive science. And my advisors in music, one of them was David Wessel, who was a pioneer in electronic music and sound synthesis. In fact, he's the guy who taught the original spectral composers about spectra. So he's like, and
Oh, very cool.
then
Yeah.
because he used to at the time work at EARCOM. He was the director of pedagogy under
Sure.
Boulez at EARCOM. So he had this like he had the understanding of not just the physics of sound, but the perception of sound and stuff, and how timbre and harmony were connected and all of that. Because he had also then used that knowledge to help some of the original inventors of analog synthesizers develop what they were doing. Then he got into interactive systems and stuff, and so he became friends with George Lewis, who was also at EARCOM at the time. Anyway, fast forward to the 90s when David Wessel became my advisor. He took me under his wing, essentially. He's like, no, let's figure out something for you to do here at UC Berkeley. And he, by then, had also become a leading figure in the field of music cognition. And always someone who would kind of intervene on the discipline with some like real, like grounded wisdom, real world kind of stuff. He had been a musician too. He had been a he wa had wanted to be a jazz drummer, and he kind of became friendly with all these avant-garde musicians like the Art Ensemble of Chicago and Cecil Taylor and Sam Rivers and all these people. And got into all these innovative ways of putting music together. So he kind of took me under his wing in the 90s, and he connected me with some other people, one of whom was George Lewis, the composer and theorist scholar. So George became one of my advisors, and the other was Ollie Wilson, the composer and ethnomusicologist, one of the revered Black composers of the 20th century. Together, they were the main team, and then there were some other people on the committee for mostly for appearances' sake. But we essentially I got into this, first of all, like checking out, sort of surveying the field of music cognition, and then I found it lacking in some crucial ways. And in particular, I felt like because the field was so Eurocentric in its orientation, it was missing a lot about, what it claimed to be universals of music were so actually provincial and particular to not just Western music, but Western classical music of that predated the 20th century. So it didn't really make sense in terms of what how we live and experience music today. So I basically tried to bring in some understanding of Black music making and Black aesthetics in dialogue with this field. And so I was also checking out this understanding of what was then called embodied cognition, which was, when we say cognition, we immediately think of the brain and mental processes, but to think of cognition actually as something that our whole body is involved in, that there's all this wisdom that our bodies have about how to do things, and that is a kind of intelligence. So once you kind of think through all the implications of the fact that music is first and foremost embodied action, then all these new details come to light about how that is, how that is true in terms of rhythm, in terms of phrasing, in terms of time, musical time, I mean, in terms of emotion. It's just all these everything in terms like putting the body first in our understanding of what music is and does and who we are through it, so that's basically what the point of my dissertation was, or at least was trying to make that I was trying to make that those points. And then as an artist, I just try to put that all into practice to answer your question finally, which you asked me about 10 minutes ago, which is how does that relate? It relates directly in the sense that it helps me understand how, a connection to sensation and to action and the role of that in music making and music perceiving, and in how we experience music in time together, to understand it as first and foremost embodied, to feel, to know that it's about movement and feeling first. And then I kind of think of, that helps me make choices as an artist about what, when I'm putting a piece of music together, first I'm thinking about how it moves and how it feels. Like those are the first decisions, essentially, before I start thinking about harmony or something like that, that's, although that is like involved in feeling, certainly.
Wonderful. Yeah, you touched on it a little bit there right at the end. The next thing I was going to ask about is how does that change how you write music, and how when you're writing for something like the violin or the piano, which are instruments you know well enough at least to understand maybe some of that physical embodiment, that intentionality, that how to make a sound. But how do you do that for other instruments you might not play, for something that I always find the voice such an odd thing to think about because it's such a physically embodied instrument. It can't get more embodied
Yes, that's
than
right.
that,
That's right.
actually. But it's also very personal and very sometimes, I think, hard to connect physical action to the output, if you will, what actually gets produced. So how do you bridge that gap when you're performing or composing, really?
Yeah, it's hard, for the instruments I don't know. I mean, I think I've spent enough time with percussion instruments that I have some sense of that, to the physicality, the sort of what lays under the hands, because like part of it is when you're writing for an orchestra, you want it to be kind of available to them as players. Like, you know that they're not going to have much time to rehearse. That's part of it. Yeah, at least in the US, in the US model of the orchestra, not much time. Not much resources, so it's always this kind of frenzy to get the piece together. And so It kind of needs to be like immediately available to the material needs to be just like, oh, I can grasp this, so I can play it, and then they can start figuring out how it all works together, you know? And so I do try to study these different aspects of the other instruments, but I will say that I don't know much about woodwinds or brass comparatively. I have much more of a tactile sense of the strings and percussion families. So I often end up just talking to folks about how certain things are going to feel, how they lay under the on the instrument, you know. Thankfully, there's a lot of wisdom out there about that. So there's plenty of the others have already solved these problems, I guess. Yeah.
Other musicians have solved them. You just need to find the answer
That's right.
and
That's
work it into
right.
what you're
That's
working on. Absolutely.
right.
When you know, we've talked a lot about kind of this, I think we'll just call it Western classical, that Western European kind of tradition. You've brought aspects of African music, West African music. You've brought aspects of more Indian music to your music. What's been the process of kind of growing and trying to incorporate more elements outside of kind of, the structures we've already talked about? And what grabs you about those things? I mean, what's the, no one needs a reason to include, a West African drum part in something because they all sound great. It's incredible music, but what kind of led you to going down those particular routes and trying to explore those musics more?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those initial explorations happened in my early 20s, which is now 30 years ago. And it's not like I want my music to sound like that or to, bring to mind like, oh, well, that's the African part or something like that. I don't know.
Right,
It's
yeah.
not, that's not at all what I'm trying to do. I mean, I ex except insofar as like I like working with musicians from other systems of knowledge, and so if like I can gain enough wisdom to play with Zakir Hussain, then that's what I want to do, like, or if I want to
Absolutely.
play with like, I don't know, Mustafa Tete Adi from Ghana, or I don't know, Tudu Njie Rose from Senegal. Like, I want to learn how to do that so I can find myself in dialogue with somebody like that. And so that's usually what that study, those studies were for. It was really like, how hands-on can I be? And can we build something together now? Not that well, I have gotten to play with Ustad Zakir Hussain, that's been amazing. The handful of time that that's happened, it's been really revelatory and exciting and very natural, actually, because we could kind of find each other somewhere in the middle. And I've worked with other tabla players and mridangam players and conga players and, djembe players and different people who play different kinds of drums and like have different rhythmic vocabularies, I guess. I think what draws me to any of it is the dance impulse in all of it, which, getting back to the embodied element in music making and the connection of mu the inherent connection of music to dance. I find that studying music for dance from around the world gives me, in particular, like, how does it move and how does it impel people to move? How is it organized that elicits movement? What kind of movement does it support and elicit? Those kinds of questions are meaningful to me because then I can work with that in my own work. A dozen years ago, I wrote a string quartet for Brooklyn Rider, this piece called Dig the Say. They had asked me like to do a piece inspired by an American artist of my choosing. And the first person I thought of was James Brown. And I decided that I wanted to make tribute to James Brown as a string quartet. And so, I had been for many years studying his music and like checking it out, transcribing it, trying to play it, trying to play along with it. There's a lot of detail in there. It's not just a bunch of four on the floor kind of basic stuff. There's immense complexity in that music, if you really study it. A lot of polyphony that sounds a lot like West African drumming, actually. The way that the dovetailing of rhythms, the dialogue among ostinati, repeat recurring elements among different ostinati, and the aliveness of it, even though there's all this repetition in it. So that was something I had spent some time checking out. And so then implementing that in a string quartet format was a little strange, but it actually worked in an interesting way. And then recently, just this spring, the New York City Ballet presented a premiere choreographed by Justin Peck to that piece, because he heard the dance element in it, and he made this incredible virtuosic set piece for a duet, for ballet people, ballet with ballet training, that brought out the kind of the rhythmic intensity and the dance impulse in it. And that was really exciting. So to see that, like, it actually does manifest in an audible way, that this is like, it actually does feel like something enough that somebody wants to dance to it, literally. And that's, like, to me, the biggest compliment. It's a higher compliment than a good review, because it's like, if someone dances to what you do, then it means it matters to them, and that's like, that says a lot. It's hard to get to that point, actually, with music, with the, kind of like omnipresence of music in our lives, to the point where none of it really seems to matter, if it matters to someone so much that their body becomes involved in it, then you've done something. Thank you.
Yeah, you've moved them to movement. It's a really
Exactly.
beautiful thing. It's one of the, I think it's one of the, I agree wholeheartedly. It's one of the most amazing feelings you can have as a musician is someone actually being moved to that kind of point,
Yeah,
to
that's right.
pick themselves up and move their body to the music. And yeah, especially with the and you yeah, kind of touched on a little bit the very beginning too, kind of the omnipresence of things, you know. Didn't realize people still made CDs. Nice that they
Exactly.
do.
How about that?
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do think we're seeing a bit of a movement back to physical media just because of precisely that, the omnipresence of a streaming service. But
Yeah.
perhaps that's a conversation for a different day. I
Yeah.
do. I really love what you're saying about the movement, the intentionality, the embodiment of music, and those aspects of it. And I want to ask a bit more particularly about your most recent, at least album release, maybe not your most recent compositions, but Asunder, Trouble for Violin and Chamber Orchestra, and Crisis Modes for percussion and strings. Did you have visions of how these might physically, how this music becomes embodied? Did you have any, doesn't sound like you have visions of dance for a piece that ended up being a ballet eventually, but what does that come up? Does that come up in the rehearsal, in the composition process, in the recording process? Like, you're splicing together things. Does it come up then? I mean, what, are you consciously thinking about embodiment throughout, I mean, specifically those processes?
It does come up because because like I said, I'm often starting from some that when I'm putting the music together, when I start as a compositional process, I start from some sense of the quality of movement. Like, what's this going to feel like as it moves? How's it going to feel to play it, or to like follow it, or to conduct it, or to witness it, you know? And the other thing was with Asunder, that was written originally for Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, and they work without a conductor, which means that they actually have to feel it. The rhythm needs to be something they all carry as an ensemble. Like, it needs to come from within. It can't, it can't just be about the concertmaster waving the scroll of her violin around like a baton. Like, that doesn't work. They need to actually feel it beat by beat collectively. And that means that they're essentially experiencing pulse together as if they're dancing together. So what that meant was that I organized it that way as a sort of series of dances. That's what it is, really, more than anything. Which meant that actually they're sort of simpler in character than the other pieces. And again, like, I made it almost like immediately available to them in terms of its aesthetic qualities too. Like, it's maybe most influenced by Duke Ellington of anything, of anything on this, of anything I've done, I would say. It's really harmonically and rhythmically informed by his music more than anything. In fact, there's this ballet that he wrote for Alvin Ailey's company called The River, and I think it's very influenced by that piece. Now that I can hear it in retrospect, I can hear that quality, not in any specific like imitative way, but more just the character of it, the sweep of it, and the recurring forms, the way things build through repetition, and a certain lyricism in it that's like tonal. It's tonal in its own way. It's not tonal in a functional way in the same, but it is like all the entities in it are tonal entities, harmonically speaking. The other pieces on there, well, the piece Crisis Modes, it's three movements, it's written for strings and percussion. The central movement in there was the beginning of it for me, and it actually started from a piano improvisation of mine, which I had a recording of, and there was something in it that I didn't quite understand. Like, there's a sort of composer brain I have, which is like, oh, this should go with this or this, it's a sort of like sometimes overly conceptual or sort of schematic kind of, like kind of become fixated on symmetries and sort of like, I don't know, just almost puzzles and things like that. It's not that that's how I hear music, but that's sort of what the kinds of decisions I end up making are often, I don't know, they're sort of abstract decisions. But then what I found myself doing as a pianist, compose like kind of real-time composer, playing piano and playing this sort of impromptu, I guess I'd call it, was that there was a kind of movement in it, a harmonic logic in it that I'm not sure I could characterize or describe or even imitate. So I wanted to study it, so I just transcribed it and I orchestrated it, and that's what that middle movement is. So since that kind of comes from me, it's almost like this emotional outpouring. It has a sort of embodied logic because it literally is my hands at the piano doing it, But I don't have a lot of like formal understanding of it. So, and nonetheless, like, it has a kind of authenticity to it that then was hard to match in the outer movements, the first and the third movement, which meant I had to kind of rewrite them and try to get to something more lyrical with them, actually. Because what the two outer movements are these kind of rhythmic propositions, I guess I'd say. But then to express that melodically was the challenge, and to get to that point, that took a couple of tries, because I wanted it to feel like something. I wanted it to catch the ear in a way, and to let melody kind of unfold in a way that is has its own logic and its own appeal and its own kind of emotionality, The middle piece that's like the heart of this album, the piece called Trouble, it comes from a lot of different places because it was like a year in the making. So it's not like there's one thing that animates it. It's kind of multiple. There are multiple concerns, I guess, that animate it. Jennifer Coe, the violinist, she commissioned it and she initiated it. And it started, you know, that wasn't the first thing we had done together, but it was first thing of this scale that I'd ever done. So it took quite a bit of care. And first of all, like I found that I needed some kind of purpose for it. And she felt the same, like it needed to somehow be of its time. And particularly like she had been commissioning a lot of composers of color, you know, American composers of color in particular. So a lot of it ended up being about that, about like, you know, living in an increasingly overtly white supremacist culture and like trying to face that as it keeps the pressure keeps mounting and as these as violence keeps breaking out, you know, vigilante killings and police killings and I don't know, like white supremacist marches and stuff like this. Like that was kind of in the air as we were making this. And of course, like that year, in fact, this premiered in at Ojai Music Festival exactly 7 years ago at the in 2017, which was the first spring of the Trump administration. And so we were right in the midst of all that, you know, in the lead up to that election and then the aftermath of that election. But even like, you know, the fact that overt white supremacist language had kind of burst into, I don't know, popular culture and into the mainstream in mainstream politics in a way that then we sort of found ourselves wanting to somehow address. I mean, and so the reason it's called Trouble is not just because we were in trouble, but because of the late Congressman John Lewis and his way of characterizing protest as, and the necessity of protest as making good trouble. So it was kind of about fighting trouble with trouble. That said, like I was thinking a lot about the relationship of the soloist to the orchestra, because I wasn't really so on board with the idea of a concerto, you know, like the heroic soloist, the sort of protagonist or something. So we had to kind of get to a different understanding of what that could be. And the way it played out is that the soloist is in a lot of like very tight dialogue with the ensemble, and to the point where it sometimes feels like chamber music more than one above many, you know. And so I think the fact that the ensemble could keep kind of telescoping to the small scale and then outward to the large scale again was helpful for me to kind of hear it that way. And that had a sort of allegorical importance, like the one among many rather than the one above many, you know. And that had this kind of political resonance for us.
Absolutely. It's a really important thing, I think, for us to talk about, and especially as musicians, artists in a field that's predominantly driven by dead white people from many, many years ago now, mostly. It's important to talk about these things and bring it up and discuss it. And maybe not to put too fine a point on it, but 2017, if that was a, I believe that was a summer festival, it would have been fairly close to when the Unite the Right Charlottesville
Yes, yeah.
riot happened. And that's a very, I think that's a very, that's a point that a lot of people, I think, can kind of point to and say that's when it got very loud, louder than it
Right.
ever had before, maybe for people who. And people who ignored it in the past couldn't ignore that anymore.
Yeah.
And it's a. I want to talk a little bit about maybe about this in your relationship, and you've touched on it a little bit, some of the music you wrote in the aftermath of 9/11, 2003, in what language, we've talked about it a little bit. But just maybe more broadly with your work and with your teaching as well. You teach music, but you're also you cross list your course load at Harvard. Some of it is also listed under African and African American studies, which is interesting, I find, and it's obviously very intentional from you. And I want to ask what the joy is in that, and what because it's obviously something that you enjoy, and it's a good thing to be doing. So what is it about that keeps you going back and having a, you're a professor, and what keeps you coming back and teaching people in these, what concepts are you teaching? How do you go about it, starting those conversations?
Yeah, it's been 10 years I've been doing it now at Harvard, and a little more, actually 10 and a half. And I try to meet students where they are and then introduce them to something beyond what they had understood or known about before. We get a lot of brilliant and talented people there, including many really exceptional musicians. Not many people go to Harvard to major in music, which puts a department like that music department in a particularly, slightly peculiar position, right? Because it's not, often people will do a kind of, maybe they'll do a double major or maybe a combined major. Or maybe they'll just take a few courses in the music department. Or maybe they'll just play in the orchestra and never take a course, or play in the jazz ensemble and not even know that there is a music department, So you kind of, and a lot of people are there with much greater ambitions than becoming an artist or something, or becoming a scholar of music. But, what I find that, especially just like introducing these different students who've been often like very individual focused in their own arc of achievement in their youth to get into Harvard, right? Like what they did was they had to be better than everybody around them and had to be like exceptional and see them, treat themselves as exceptions. And what it is to be an artist in the world or to make music with people is something very different, which is much more about being part of a community, actually, and being connected to others and making things that matter to other people, not just as feathers in your cap, And it's funny because for the whole, like, let's say the whole neoliberal 21st century, we've been told that artists need to be entrepreneurs. And I swear to God, if I hear that sentence one more time, I'm gonna like
You
punch
won't hear
somebody.
it from me. You'll
That's
never hear me say
good.
that. So
I mean, I don't
don't
know. I don't
worry.
even know what it means. It's kind of like,
It's a great
you know
question.
what it's there's this book by a wonderful literary scholar who passed away. Their name was Lauren Berlant. The book is called Cruel Optimism. And that's kind of what I think when I hear that sentence about artists need to be entrepreneurs. It's like, keep trying, little buddy. The system doesn't care about you, but if you vanquish your opponents, then maybe you too can have a life for a few years before it swallows you too. It's kind of like it's just cruelty, So how do we instead like develop a sense of an ethic of mutual care and respect and support, and I find that the best way to do that is to get people collaborating on things. So that's one of the probably most popular courses that I've offered over the years. It's almost like a reality show, actually. The only criterion is that you have to already be making your own music, whatever that means. The main person that that type of person that tends to exclude is someone who's like a lifelong classical musician who's never made their own music. But there are a lot of other kinds of folks who do make their own music, whether they're jazz people or people who make beats in their bedroom or singer-songwriters or people who write Broadway music or like who write musicals or MCs, sound artists, a lot of different kinds of folks can be in this class. And some people who make who are classically trained who also do something else, like a cappella stuff or something, And so then I assign them into groups, and then they have to figure out how to make music together. So often it's like each ensemble comprises folks from all different backgrounds musically, but they have to learn to honor each other's ideas and respect each other and make something together, and then they have to perform it. So after a month, basically after 4 weeks, they put on a concert, and then that process is can be hugely rewarding for them because they often didn't know that certain things are possible, and often they get into some unprecedented stuff, and then we do that cycle 3 times, so they get scrambled into different groups each month. And it's been really, really fruitful and beautiful to see what they come up with together. And particularly that they have to take individual success off the table. It's all about what it is that they can do together. And once you start thinking in that way, the basic question of what is it that we can do together? That's a political question, and they start acting more like community organizers. And that to me is the real thing that artists need to be. That's the real role that we can assume. So that's one thing I do. I also teach some academic courses, often focusing on Black music making, and Black music makers. I also did a course on Asian American music makers, and I founded a doctoral program in the Department of Music. It's called Creative Practice and Critical Inquiry. So that's we only let in one student a year into that program, and so they tend to be pretty special, each one of them in their own way. And basically, the idea is that these exceptional artists who have a research sensibility, such that they can realize some of their goals using all the resources of Harvard, including all the different disciplines that are represented. So often these folks are doing these interdisciplinary projects, and they're in dialogue with different fields in the humanities and social sciences and with other art disciplines and stuff. It's been really nice. Some brilliant folks have come through.
Yeah, I think it's really encouraging to hear just about, the way that you're going about it and the way as well that it seems to affect the people who go through your courses. Like you said, I agree completely, that as artists we're here to serve a community, to be a community, to be part of a community. I don't know anybody personally, and of course this is anecdotal, but I don't know really anybody who got into music to just play it by themselves. That's never really the reason we are here, and you don't write music just to be performed in a vacuum by nobody. Like you said, the embodiment, the intentionality, the collegiality of getting together and learning something together and playing really changes the way you think about community. And I think you're very, very right. And I think it's a probably a great place for us to leave off with that nice, not the message of doom and gloom, but the nice message of hope and that, artists can be not entrepreneurs, but community members, community organizers, engagers, and this kind of thing. So thank you so much for being here today. And yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew.
Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit with a mission to provide equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. If you would like to support Relevant Tones, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/relevanttones. For $5 a month, you can support this great podcast that brings creative music to you every week. For Relevant Tones, I'm Matthew Dosland. Thank you so much for listening.